podcast, Shopomaniacs. Y'all are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave in the house with the kids doing the homeschool. Oh gosh, here we're still doing it. Rupert with me is Chris.
Doesn't sound like that's going to change anytime soon, Mr. Dave. Here, yeah.
Well, you know, it just keeps going, doesn't it? Welcome to 2020.
Yeah, my back, I'll tell you what, though, just as important follow-up that I'm sure everybody listens to the show cares about, my back, totally fine. It's healed. It's great. My chest and legs, on the other hand, after being hit by a freaking van, they're less okay. But it
I was going to say, you solved the back problem by getting hit by a car.
I can't recommend it enough. You know, your back hurts. Yeah. Just stand in front of a van. Yes. Please don't
best
do that.
Best chiropractic out of the world you can buy, really. You know?
All right. Well,
sorry, man. Hopefully you're feeling better.
No, and it could have been a lot worse. This was just me hitting the pavement. The van was barely involved other than forcing me to do it. We have a special guest on today, which is fantastic. We probably should have had him on a long time ago because we're big fans on the show. Very interesting fellow with a very interesting career and just a big thinker, I think, about a lot of things, front-end web development. It's Sean Wang, probably better known to the world as Swix, though, and we've mispronounced that and screwed that up about 10 times on the show, I think. How you doing, Swix?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Long time listener, first time caller. Love saying that.
Sure. Well, we really appreciate you being here, taking time out of your busy Amazon-related day these days, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What part of it? I have literally no idea. Are you on like Amplify or what, something AWS related, or not even that, or what's up?
Yeah, totally. It is Amplify. Amplify is kind of like where you'll see most of the front-end related stuff coming out of Amazon. But there are other, obviously, thousands of Amazon employees working in front-end, not, you know, serving front-end developers.
Yeah, well, surely, right? Amazon is awesome that way. So when I said Amplify, I just threw a dart there. I can't believe I hit it. That's awesome. It's kind of a, I don't know, it feels new-ish at Amazon, because I think a lot of people think of Amazon as like, I don't know, they have AWS. I mean, so let's focus it on that. We know that freaking runs half the web or whatever it is. I don't have any actual metrics, but a lot, you know, like even at CodePen, we use like a wide swath of AWS services, all the way from just spinning up servers and databases and stuff to stuff like serverless abilities and all that. But yeah, you don't often think of it as like the most simple stuff in the world. It's like, it's the metal, it's the low level stuff that you build other stuff on. And there's lots of companies and businesses in the world that exist off of the infrastructure of AWS, knowing that it's this complicated infrastructural stuff. And that's how it's supposed to be. But directly from Amazon, that doesn't have to be the case, right? Amazon or Amplify feels like a stab at, no, we can offer simple, useful stuff directly to developers, individual developers as well. And that's what Amplify feels like to me. It's like, well, here's Auth. Here's a data store. It's easy. Look. How did I do?
I think you did a pretty good job. Yeah. I don't know if I would ever use the word easy, because that, like, you know, the moment you fall into some kind of edge case or other, you get complaints about that. But I think definitely it could be a lot easier for front-end developers. So I think, you know, Amazon is a very generalized computing platform, but the developer experience hasn't necessarily been optimized for front-end developers. Amplify is actually very focused on that, kind of building a layer to interface with all the other stuff that you have to use to get going with Amazon with best practices like CloudFormation. But you don't have to learn it. You don't have to do that to get started. I think what sets it apart from, I guess, other cloud services is that because it's provided by the cloud itself, you can actually, I guess, eject. And you're just using the raw super scalable services.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. So because you might be like, I'm going to start on Amplify, but at least then I'm still on AWS. So if things get weird, I can jump out of whatever Amplify is giving me, but I'm still in the right place.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it's open source tooling. So it's a CLI, it's JavaScript libraries that are kind of SDKs that interface with the infrastructure that you spin up. And all of this open source, and it spits out raw CloudFormation that actually spits up all that infrastructure that you might need. And yeah, you can totally eject. And I think that's something that's underrated, because it means, I think there's two things that it means. It means that you can take over and customize anything that you particularly want, but then also there's no cost. Like the tool you're using is open source, and you're mm-hmm. you're using the lowest level, you know, primitive that AWS offers. There's no sort of intermediate vendor costs in between. So I think that's an interesting pitch from that angle. I think it ends up that actually Amplify has two customers. So even though it's originally intended for front-end developers and mobile developers, the back-end teams who are familiar with AWS are also finding it easier to spin up services that they're comfortable with using Amplify as well. So it
comes because of the scaffolding, the CLI stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
So it actually works out that it kind of has two masters, which is an interesting prioritization from a product perspective, because the people who are very familiar with Amplify with Amazon spend more, whereas the people who are, you know, kind of just trying it out, dipping their toes in, may not spend more, but they may be numerically larger. So you kind of have two priorities there. Like, do you serve the power users, or do you serve kind of the newbies? I'm sure, you know, anyone who's worked on a product has done this. Go ahead.
Certainly you get like serverless functions, right, as part of an Amplify setup. Sure, right. So, okay, I want one of those. And via CLI, it's got deployment too. Do I type like Amplify deploy or something? Is it as easy as that?
Publish. Amplify publish.
Okay. So mm-hmm. It's almost like then competitive against something like serverless.com, right? Or because it's like I might use that because they help me get stuff onto Lambda, because otherwise that's not the most ergonomic thing in the world. They've built their whole their whole business around that, essentially. But now all of a sudden you've got a player directly in that. I can use Amplify as my carrier to getting stuff onto a Lambda or anything else too. I didn't mean to just focus on Lambdas, but that's where my brain is at a lot, because I think serverless functions are cool, and the story to get them live and maintain them is often a bit weird.
Yeah, totally. I think you have that right. I think the perspective, because you and I are front end, and it's so weird to say you and I because I'm not anywhere as experienced as you are. But from our front end perspective, serverless functions are, you know, only useful if they're exposed to the public internet. But we have to remember that the vast majority of serverless functions are internal. Like they're sort of glue code on top of existing state changes from databases, for example, or, you know, between different microservices, all that kind of stuff. Like so serverless framework is a third party framework, but then it's also sort of generalized for the generic use case, whereas Amplify is very focused on that front end framework. So it'll spin up an API gateway, which you need to expose the service function to the public internet.
Right.
Like stuff like that is just kind of abstracted away for you, which is pretty similar to what Netlify does as well.
Yeah, right. Netlify tries to help with this too, because you just have that functions folder and it just automatically becomes these public facing URLs for that, which is pretty cool, honestly. I think it's proven out. And we talked to Brian from Begin, and so there's like this whole market for like, help me with the CI/CD of serverless.
I think one of the pain points is that there's so many equivalent ways of doing these things that, you know, it's very confusing for someone kind of new to the space to evaluate all the different options. That's why I think that sites like your Power Serverless site can be really helpful in giving information for people to evaluate. Because I'm obviously, you know, biased by the people that I work for, but this information is important and it needs to get out there. Like, what are the trade-offs when you pick between different providers?
You know, and the companies aren't particularly incentivized to help you understand the landscape, like truly as it is, you know? Like, Microsoft has lots of interesting, cool things they're doing with cloud stuff. I'm speaking at one of their little conferences in a week or two, and that's great. They're a part of this world too, but none of the, like, Amazon isn't particularly compelled to tell you about what AWS has going on. And Microsoft isn't particularly incentivized to tell you how their stuff stacks up against AWS. I mean, maybe once in a while you'll see a little, let me tell you how it is, but
unlabeled chart that just says fast
competitor A, competitor B. I mean, you know, like, you know, there's actually strict policy when you take sort of the media training at these companies that you cannot say anything about competitors. And I think that's fair. Like you would not want someone who doesn't know you super well to present you in a bad light. That's super unfair to what it is. But yeah, I mean, that's why I think having independent third party experts kind of survey the field, I think that's the best we can hope for, really.
You're dead right about them. So just not to change gears entirely, but just a little bit, I think of you as also kind of a React person, you know, because you just you've written a lot of it, you write a lot about it. You're I believe a mod or the mod of Reddit's r React, whatever you
yeah,
call it.
Yeah, r/react.js, the front page of Reddit, front page of React is what we call it.
Yeah, well, because it's Hopin, right? Like, not a lot of... There's probably an R code pen, too, but I don't know. I've probably never even looked at it, you know? Like this one is actually, like, very, very bustling, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's a function of whether or not the core team prioritizes it. Like, you could make R code pen active if you showed up on there. So people will go wherever they get access to people who, you know, who are in the know. And for whatever reason, r/react.js has the right amount of people. Mm-hmm. Just like for those who don't know my story, I changed careers 3-ish, 4-ish years ago. I got my start with Vue because I found it much easier to get started.
What did you change careers from? Was it very different? Were you like a firefighter or something?
I wish. That'd be way more interesting. No, I was in finance, you know, the other super gender diverse industry. I did investment banking and hedge funds for about 6 years. Essentially burned out by not being that great at the finance bit, but I learned to code as part of my job. And I think something that a lot of programmers, kind of card-carrying programmers, don't appreciate is that a lot of people who don't carry the title of like software engineer are learning to code as part of their job. And some of them get good at it, and that was me. So I was learning Python. I had to learn Haskell because I had no choice. People were very impressed that I did production Haskell for 2 years, but I had no choice and just powered through it.
Wow.
But like, you know, I didn't know. Yeah. No one, if no one tells you it's hard, then you just, you think that's just the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I don't mean to interrupt, but I was watching a Microsoft Ignite thing just the other day, and they're talking about AI and building no code AI apps inside what Microsoft Office or something like that. And I just was like, and they kept using this phrase. They were like, you know, you may have to bring in a developer, but what we're trying to enable casual coders, I think was the term they used. And, you know, a casual coder is just stitching together an AI that then, you know, and I'm just like, that's casual? Or like in your situation, it's like running production Haskell. That's like intro to web work. Development. Yeah. Like what's going, like, this is shocking my brain because it's just like the standards of what we call things are just so like out there. But I like this idea, like, that it's not just developers who are coding. Lots of people are coding as a part of their job. It's just, and they may not realize how serious the level of programming is. Yeah. That's very interesting to me.
I have so many responses to that. So I'll kind of take it back to, you know, I got started, you know, in finance, everyone uses Excel, and Excel is, you know, famously a programming language that's reactive and very intuitive in terms of user interface. But then you need to automate Excel, so then you get into VBA, and then you start to run into the memory limits of Excel, so you move off of Excel to Python, and then you need to do parallel calculations, and then you go to Haskell, or what's the other? OCaml, which mm-hmm. finance people love a lot.
Well, that was an interesting 15 seconds of audio.
No, I mean, like, yeah, seriously, like, you know, tens of thousands of people are doing this, at least in finance, I think, you know, people who are consider themselves classical programmers don't really consider the amount of on-ramp that is coming in. Like, software is eating the world, and this is an interesting aspect of it. So my, you know, kind of bringing it back to my story, I turned from casual to maybe thinking that maybe I should do this for a full-time job. So essentially I did free code camp during nights and weekends for 6 straight months, no 0 days. And that was the article, the blog post that I wrote about that. And then I finished FreeCode Camp, did not feel qualified to look for a job because it was free. What did I know? So I went for a boot camp, and the boot camp actually did help me get a job. So it was a bet that worked out. And during that period, I actually picked Vue because Vue was the much easier framework to get started with, at least, you know, when I was looking at it. And also, I think Evan was in New York, and it was kind of, you know, I went to a few Vue meetups and he was there, and that really helps a lot in terms of your intent to adopt things. But then I realized I wanted a job and money, and React was much more popular. So I went into React.
Just based on its popularity, that's interesting. Why not? That's probably.
People like make a big deal out of like use the best tool for the job, but sometimes you use the best tool that gets you a job. You know.
Yeah. Sure.
Good perspective. Yeah.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by FaunaDB. So, you know, we've talked about Jamstack a million times on this show. It's a nice stack. We've also mentioned that, you know, part of the weirdness of it is that it's not really a stack and that it doesn't like prescribe the tools that you use. It's just kind of like a philosophy. Well, what if you need a database still? Just because your Jamstack doesn't mean you don't need a database. I mean, what you can have a Jamstack approach, but still have certain pages that then hit like a cloud data storage place for that data. Where is that? What are you going to use? Use FaunaDB. FaunaDB is a fully featured database that just has an API to that data. So it frictionlessly fits into your Jamstack world, you know? You talk to it with serverless functions, and it doesn't care how you do that, you know? Put them on Netlify, put them on Vercel, you know? Use Cloudflare workers, AWS Lambda, Azure Functions, whatever. FaunaDB doesn't care. It gives you total freedom of your database operations. Yeah. So, and it, you know, just like that, it doesn't care about your front end framework either. You know, you're building a React site, Angular site, Vue, Ember, Elm, whatever. It doesn't matter. With FaunaDB, you add the global store, get it set up in a couple of minutes, and your data then is accessible via API with GraphQL support, custom business logic, the whole deal. So, serverless is like the spiritual partner of Jamstack. So, you know, serverless meaning I'm going to talk to a serverless function, have that function get and manipulate data for me and build a Jamstack site. I think it's an awesome way to work. Thanks so much for the support. FaunaDB. So go to check this out, fauna.com/Jamstack. Get you started for free.
You know, this is fascinating to me because you said you've only been like a web dev professional here for like 3-4 years. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
I'm not misquoting that. Nope. I mean, because my situation and how I'm exposed to your work most often is I search for some technology on YouTube and there's a video with you and the maintainer of the software like talking about it. So it seems like not only have you like been a Vue professional and then like, or been into Vue and then not a React professional and Reddit maintainer, but you also have a broad set of technologies that you've like been exposed to. And maybe that was part of like your Netlify work or something, but why do you know so much technology? It would be my question.
I don't. That's the straight honest answer. I actually don't have that good of a YouTube presence. As well, I honestly got lucky with your searches. I am interested like intellectually between like the different frameworks. I think they're all, you know, contributing something to the discussion. So I definitely spend a lot of time, more time than probably is sane, researching these things and actually comparing and making friends with the maintainers. I definitely view that as part of my talent set because. You don't have to know everything. You just have to know the maintainers of everything, and that'll get you pretty far.
Yeah, that's a nice trick. That's a nice trick. One I've used many times, you know?
Like, oh, I do. I mean, it's some of it, right? Is like the best way to get the answer is to complain on Twitter.
Yeah. I don't know. No, we learned that lesson on this podcast a little bit, because it's like you can email anybody and they'll just, and then you're like, how about you? Do you want to just sit down and talk for an hour and record it? How's Thursday in the absolute middle of a workday? And the chances of getting a yes are like super high. Even in the early days of this show, not that this we're that famous or anything now, but like, the amount of yeses you get for a let's chat is real high.
Yeah, we had Paul Irish on once, and he doesn't talk to nobody.
So. Fair enough. He liked one of my Instagrams recently, and I'm like, ooh, a rare Paul sighting from the wild.
The Rush. I actually kind of wonder what he's up to, because his YouTube videos on jQuery were pretty popular back in the day.
Oh, I think he's doing a lot. It's just behind the scenes these days. Let's see. But one of the reasons I brought up React is because does Amplify care about React? Is it? It's very much a front end thing, as you're saying. It's React. It's foundationally a React thing.
Amplify is not tied into React, but obviously it has sort of integration libraries that you can choose to use if you wish, with Vue, React, Flutter. iOS and Android. Yeah, it's, you know, kind of framework agnostic in that sense, but it does offer integration SDKs. And obviously, because React is so popular, React is actually, React developers are the biggest consumers of Amplify. So definitely, if anything gets tested at Amplify, it is the React integrations to make sure that nothing breaks. Because
you get users. A little bit of SDK action for it, but it's framework agnostic. That's cool. What isn't agnostic about it? Like, do you get you? It's I assume there's like a GraphQL component to it, probably.
Yeah, but you could choose to use REST or GraphQL. I don't think there's a.
It's not even opinionated there. What is it opinionated about?
it's opinionated on platform. You should probably want to deploy on AWS if you're picking Amplify. And really kind of it's very pluggable in the sense that even the off solutions, the storage solutions, they're all designed to be swappable out to any sort of underlying implementation. So for example, the default off provider of Amazon is Cognito, but let's say you don't want to use Cognito, you can use Okta or Auth0. That's the vision. Amplify is 3 years into this. The reality is that the third-party ecosystem for plugins hasn't been built out yet. So kind of really relies on the continued growth of this to become a thing, and then it will be kind of like a self-sustaining thing where people will write plugins. But the architecture is set up so that in future it will be set up like that. So in the meantime, yes, it will be opinionated on basically saying, if you want all these AWS services, it will spin it up for you. If you want to plug in third party, you can bring your own, but you're kind of more on your own there.
Mm-hmm. So this seems, you know, like if you're like, I'm going to use Cognito or some third party auth, and I'm going to use, you know, a database in the sky, and I'm going to use some serverless functions and stuff. That's all stuff that seems spiritually connected to Jamstack. You know, that's like this, like the serverless architecture way, but serverless and Jamstack are like spiritual buddies. So what's the pre-render story then? Does Amplify help with the kind of the final attack on Jamstack or the original thing? Like, is pre-rendering kind of you're on your own?
Basically the same story as Netlify, mainly because I'm super I'm most familiar with Netlify, but you know, there's a CI/CD service called Amplify Console. It does the same thing, just runs your build, whatever build process you want, including pre-rendering, and then pushes out to CDN, and for AWS, that's CloudFront. Again, like, you know, everything but the AWS version of it. And I think that's a fair enough proposition. I think what's interesting now is this contention between Vercel and what pre-rendering means, because they do kind of stale wall revalidate serverless hosting. And so that's something that I don't think Amplify or Netlify supports right now, but it's clearly something that is a very key value proposition of Next.js. So I think all platforms are working towards supporting.
They're kind of playing both sides of the aisle, which we'll see if that ends up being smart or not. But like, I even had an ancient PHP site just super old. And the only reason I did it in PHP was just to do little include statements, right? Like, oh, include my header on these 8 pages. It was for some like friend of my dad who had a local repair company and he wanted to show some like bathroom remodelings online. You know, who knows? I wrote this over a decade ago for sure. But I was closing down old servers, you know, like, ah, I need to get rid of this ancient thing that I pay monthly for. Get rid of that. And I was like, where can I put it? Where do you put like a baby PHP site these days that isn't like Bluehost or something? Nothing against Bluehost, but that's what I was trying to not do, you know? And Vercel has a thing, you know, like you can deploy a little PHP site on it and it treats the PHP a little bit like a cloud function. You know, you can write a cloud function. Cloud function doesn't mean node necessarily. You know, on AWS, you can write a cloud function in tons of languages, Ruby, whatever, you know. And so it's like, because Vercel supports that too. I don't know what they're, what's the behind the scenes at Vercel? Is it AWS? Maybe not. Maybe they
oh, yeah,
whoever's cheaper. Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I think Guillermo hand evaluates every...
Well, if you're at scale, I would think that you'd write it agnostically, right? So if Microsoft came knocking at your door and they offered you some crazy deal, you'd be like, okay, we'll run it on your crap now. Why not?
Yeah.
But anyway, so I moved it to Vercel, which is kind of cool. But that's just one example. Like they're very much in the like, sure, we're Jamstack. We'll serve your stuff off CDNs and static host away. But if you need a little node server behind it, fine. We can totally do that too. They just play both sides. They're like, yeah, we like Jamstack and we like servers.
I think that was old Zeit, but you know Zeit V2 and now Vercel is all in on serverless. And I should also probably point out that Amplify is very very much the same way. It's the bet on the serverless future of Amazon, and I think it's you know the internal adoption and the. It's kind of like okay, like this is not officially approved messaging, so please don't quote me on this. Sure. But it's kind of like the facade pattern, you know, like Amazon's built on EC2 and like you know a bunch of server full technologies. But like let's establish this new brand name, and you know, and all the technologies in it are sort of serverless or serverless compatible, and yeah, like let's just get a bunch of developers onto this thing, and then they won't even know that they're using Amazon underneath. Like they're just using Amplify.
Hmm. That's like a longer term play. I know this is not official messaging.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I kind of see it like that. That was my pitch. So you know, when I joined Amazon, I kind of wrote the blog post, kind of detailing how I see Amazon as Amazon approaching the front end ecosystem. So that's kind of how I pitched it, and I didn't get chewed out for it. So I assume it's okay.
Oh, nice. On your site, you should fix this because I want to go because you have a little post. First look at AWS Amplify Flutter, and I really want to read it. But when you click it, at 500s, so you got a little work to do.
Yes, I am about to actually ship I've been rewriting my site. So
yay, nice! I can tell little changes because you used to have the world's coolest like candy bar scroll bar, and I see it's this little green blob. Which
that actually depends on your screen width. So I changed that.
Oh, I have it really small. Oh, you're right. Oh my gosh,
that's so what I obviously rookie mistake. I took that from CSS Tricks, and I didn't like the look of it for small windows, so I changed it to the green bar for mobile view.
I get an email once a week, maybe, that somebody is saying like, "Ugh, the fact that you override scrolling behavior with JavaScript leads to extreme jank as you're scrolling down the page," kind of thing. I'm like, guess what? I didn't do that. It's just CSS, bro. It's all good. You liar.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Framer. That's framer.com/shoptalk. Go there, sign up for free, get 20% off any paid plan. That's very generous. Thank you, Framer. When you've spent hours designing something beautiful for the web, the last thing you want to hear is, oh, sorry, we can't build this. You know, what you need is a tool that bridges the gap between design and development. Framer can be that bridge. It's a browser-based prototyping tool that enables designers to use code-backed components and dynamic transitions to visually express ideas. So when the time comes that, you know, you perhaps as the designer are giving it to a developer, the developer can jump in and easily inspect the elements, get the CSS or the JSX right from there. Custom animations, custom built with magic motion. It's powered by Framer Motion, which is an open source library that's awesome. You should check out for React. It all comes with a complete clean code, which can be taken right from Framer, and you can move it right into production. So it's the gap. It's the Framer is the bridge. So sign up for free or get 20% off any paid plan by visiting framer.com/shoptalk. That's framer.com/shoptalk.
Okay, so we're in finance. The first, you know, Quincy Larson spills the beans in the intro to the book that says you left a career that was pretty deep into the six figures to come do this. So hope that was worth it. I mean, I know it is because it involves your brain and your life. So money isn't everything, of course. But that's pretty wild. And then came over here to coding land. And then we're at Netlify for a while, which, wow, you know, a lot of people's dream job there. I'm sure that was kind of a cool moment for you. And now we're at Amazon, which is probably even more people's dream job. Wow, good job. And no wonder that you were in finance, the money's on the brain at least a little bit. You probably can't avoid it these days. Are a bit entrepreneurial in the things that you do. And an example of that is this book, right? You get to talk about yourself in that transition. The book's called Coding Career. Yeah.
Yeah. The Coding Career Handbook. It was originally called Cracking the Coding Career, to kind of draft off of Cracking the Coding Interview. And then Gail McDowell, the author, got in touch with me and mentioned the word lawyers, so then I had to change it.
By having a book title that's a little bit similar to something else, hot take, what a dick move.
It was reasonable. So I'll defend her.
Okay.
So you can't trademark a book title. So you could actually, you know, publish a book titled, I don't know, Great Gatsby, and not be sued. You can publish the exact same title as someone else. Okay. That's fine. But if an author has published a series of books with all the same patterns, and a new book could be reasonably mistaken to be part of that series when it's not, or affiliated with that series and it's not, then that's a trademark.
Okay.
So you can't call Harry Potter and the Dave Rupert Code School. That's illegal. I understand.
Well, you'd be fighting with J.K. Rowling, but.
Amplify for Dummies. It's probably not going to fly either. Yeah,
I think that might work. You know, again, not official statement, but you know, I didn't know any of this when I was just shipping a book. Like, so the backstory with this was I had 2 months in between leaving Netlify and joining Amazon, and I was like, what am I going to do with these 2 months? Originally, I was going to goof off on my Nintendo Switch, and that got old after a week. So I was like, all right, let's ship a side project and try to make some money. And you know, I think my writing has been very eclectic. I do a lot of non-technical and technical writing. For better or worse, the non-technical stuff is the one that, you know, gets a lot more attention. And so I decided to you know, turn that into a book. Essentially, a quarter of the book is kind of revamped blog posts, and then three quarters is new. But essentially, kind of wrote down everything I knew about, like, what makes sense in a career. Obviously, I haven't had that long of development career, of dev career, but I have had, you know, a decent success in two careers so far. But I've also, you know, absorbed a lot of wisdom from other people, including both of you. I think both of you are quoted in the book. Chris, you're quoted for Build in Public, which is one of your old blog posts about building CodePen. And then Dave, I quoted you about your surfing analogy, I think, which is very recent. It actually came in like a day before I launched, and I heard it on this show, and I was like, oh, I need to put that in there.
Oh, great. Well, I should say too, I was like, oh, Sean wrote a book and is in appointment. Let me check this out. And lo and behold, dear listener, it's like a 500-page book with, like, is it four, like, well-organized sections? Like, so you don't have to, like, read it all in one sitting, but, like, each section kind of is very, like, intelligently grouped.
It really is. You did 500 pages.
Smashing job. And but I just was like, how far could somebody get in a book in their off time, you know? And you knocked it out of the park. So great.
I appreciate that.
How's it going? Is it working? Are you selling it? You making money? Come on, man.
Selling it. I'm at, I think I broke 50K last week. And that's a decent side project money for 2 months. Yeah, and you know, like it wasn't like off time. Like I was unemployed, and I wrote this every day for 12 hours a day for I think 600 hours is what I counted. Beyond that, you know, the thinking that went into it and the note taking, which I stress about a lot. Like you can't just like sit down and write a book. Like you should have gathered some point of view or gather a lot of resources. I linked to 1400 sort of external resources, partially to compensate for my own imposter syndrome, but then also cite and attribute ideas that are not mine to the people that came up with them. So you can't just like come up with that, you know, sitting down and kind of I call this mise en place writing. Like kind of you gather the things that you're going to refer to in a good note taking system, so that when you sit down to write, you have everything in front of you.
Well, that's great advice. I totally agree with all aspects of that. You know, you don't as much as, you know, it's glamorized that you may, you know, rent a hotel room in the forest or whatever, or a cabin and just have a blank piece of paper and a typewriter and you just start typewriting. It's really more like you have 55 tabs open and like a weird note-taking apps because you couldn't decide on just one, and you know, your document's a big disaster. Yeah, more accurate.
I think there's a process towards developing thoughts as well. You know, you should always. It's kind of like developing that startup mentality, like have a small MVP of a thought, and then you flesh it out more and you flesh it out more. So I think that's where Twitter really comes in handy, because you can put out something small. That's all you're allowed to do. You can get instant feedback on it, and then you can develop it further. So a lot of things start out sort of being tested on Twitter. I think that's also where I think one of my most popular talks is the talk on React hooks that I did at JSConf Asia. And that started as a tweet. Dan Abramov helped me shape it, and that became a blog post, and then the blog post became a talk. And the talk was very well received, but people don't know the 6 months of work before that brought that talk into being. And it's very much similar to achieving any sort of substantial piece of work. I think it's, you start small and then you go big.
You still like hooks? What? You still in on hooks?
I like hooks. Yeah. I think they're major, like they make, it's surprising how bad they make classes look for you. Like before hooks, you're like, this is how things are done in React, and like I'm getting paid money to do this. So I'll overcome any obstacle to to learn this stuff. And then hooks came along and really simplified a lot of that code.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're in a weird place with them where they've been out long enough that
you just now it's cool to hate on them. Yeah.
Yeah. Or something.
People hate on them.
You just almost hear nothing at all about them. It's just like,
yeah, I think they're a fact of life. I mean, they're just like such a good idea that, Vue 3 just came out last week, and their composition API is pretty much entirely influenced by hooks. And in some senses, actually better. And Svelte also did a major rewrite, also influenced by hooks. So these ideas just keep coming from React, and, you know, you got to really give credit to them for being always being innovators. The stuff that's coming down the pike has taken longer. The wait for React Suspense has been very frustrating, but they really want to deliver a more comprehensive solution. And it's very much reflective of React itself changing from a library towards more of a full stack framework. So future versions of React will involve, more intense parts of server-side rendering than they have before.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, and I've seen too just a few announcements. You know, I think React was kind of like, we're not making any breaking changes, or but then there's been a few things they've had to kind of fudge on. So, and that's as bad as that is. If you're stuck on what React, whatever, I think that's like a sign of progress is happening. They're having to make hard decisions. So,
that's cool. Yeah. Yeah. And I think something that is becoming more evident now is that, React is very much built for Facebook needs. And it turns out that a lot of companies are not Facebook. I used to think that the kind of React game, the frameworks game was over and I was all in on React. And recently I've been diversifying more. And I think all these are, you know, this is a mix of technical and non-technical, but I kind of view these as like the same bucket in my mind. So like, you know, a full quarter of the book is about strategy. And I kind of bring my finance background into that discussion. Like whenever, you know, both of you saw my post on the third age of JavaScript, like I definitely view where we are in this point in history as just, you know, one point in a broader story. And I try to think about like where that's taking us to. And yeah, so you know, I think that there's something bigger going on, and I think that we should always, you know, keep a lookout in as to what we're investing in, and is the investment thesis for that changing? And I definitely try to, you know, be hyper aware of that.
What do you think is going to happen with SSR like long term? Like, is React going to be like, here's our official word on it? This is how you should do it. Or is it going to be like, you should use Next because they kind of have a lock on
it? Exactly. I was actually telling Tim, I think the first time I met Tim Likens, the maintainer, I was like, either you know, Zeit should acquire React or React should acquire Zeit, and just like make this one thing. Because like the endorsement at this stage is very, very strong. Google Chrome is contributing weekly to Next.js, to the exclusion of other React meta frameworks, which is like, it's neither here nor there, right? Like it's not really super fair to the other meta frameworks, but then at the same time, Next.js is the biggest one and has had the biggest investment. So I can see how that plays out on both sides. But yeah, I where we are now structurally in the organizational spectrum, SSR seems to be separate from React because because Facebook, you know, has a completely different architecture that's based on, you know, their own assumptions.
That's what I mean. Like, what about the rest of us that didn't go down the Next path a whole bunch of years ago, but totally did go down the React path years ago, have a very modern React app, we're on the latest version, we're using the latest stuff, we're using the latest Apollo. It's like a really nice React app, but now it's time to be like, oh crap, we can't ignore SSR any longer. Where do you turn?
I think it'll be Next.js. I think that's like the way that we have it now is a good happy medium. No, it's not mm-hmm. fully integrated like some other frameworks might be. But you have to remember that, you know, React also supports React Native. In fact, the React Native team is like twice as big, maybe more, the size of the React core team. And yeah, there's no point doing SSR for React Native, right? So yeah, so I mean, to be honest, like I think if you want a good sort of web solution, probably the other frameworks are better to start with. And then if you need something cross-platform, you go with React. That's where I'm at now, which is like kind of a hottish take. I have a post sitting in my drafts, basically saying why basically laying out my reasons why I say that people should use Svelte for sites and React for apps. And I think that's the division that I've kind of landed on.
Hot take indeed. Tweet it. Okay. Well, Dave, do you have any thoughts on this before I throw it?
No, I guess like this third age of JavaScript post you mentioned, like it's it's a thinker, right? It's kind of like we're kind of haphazard, a decade ago, and then we've started having some kind of mature componentization. But then your third age, and maybe I can describe it and you can tell me what's wrong, is like we kind of now have modules and like officially, and so like that kind of opens up sort of new territory for performance and things like that. So mm-hmm. I guess when do you think the third age happens, or when do we enter nirvana here for JavaScript? I don't know, the third age.
So I always feel a bit of imposter syndrome around this because I obviously wasn't around for the second age. You know, I wasn't around for that major transition into jQuery and then out. I came in, you have to remember I came in and Vue was like the new hotness. And so, you know, I'm reconstructing, you know, I probably spend a lot more time diving through historical accounts than most people that I know. And so I kind of reconstructed the best efforts, but I'm definitely interested in both of your thoughts on this. But I think it's happening right now. I think what Fred Schott's doing with a Pika package or Snowpack or whatever he calls it.
Yes.
And everyone's adopting this sort of ES modules first approach.
Yes.
You know, ESM is unflagged in Node.js. IE Internet Explorer is slowly dying. You know, I have another post on the time frame, but it actually, you know, the first window for IE support to die is actually in October next month. But it stretches out for the next 7 years, so it's not that as exciting. but yeah, like as all those old assumptions go away, I think that gives us a lot of basis for new approaches to come up. And you're also starting to see deprecations of sort of second age frameworks like Moment.js, which just happened as of the time of recording. And I think we start to see this. Mm-hmm. Like we start to see deprecations of old tech or like old tech kind of in maintenance mode, you know, not so much, they're so predicated on previous assumptions that they can't really sort of rewrite everything. And then you see sort of new tech rising up without those assumptions. So one of the other projects that I really, really recommend everyone listening to check out is Vite from the Vue ecosystem. And Vite and Snowpack both have this idea of sort of the dev server can take advantage of the ES modules to not compile the entire app. So it has very, very fast reloading. For them, it's, you know, they kind of marketed as constant time reloading because you don't have to recompile every file or every time you change every file in the app, every time you change a single file to refresh what you're developing. And so that's interesting.
No, I just used Vite because I'm got a little side project and it was like, okay, I have to like rewrite it. And so it's like, I'll just might as well just use Vue 3 and Vite just to try it out, you know? And I was impressed. And just because, you know, anytime you're doing a side project, right, the first whatever few days, it's really just fighting build tools. It feels like, you know, you're like, okay, I wanted SAS, but good, now I'm stuck, you know, or whatever. But the tangled, is tangled very web. Like,
how do you Google yeah, it? What is it?
It's a tangled V-E-E-T web, but like,
V-I-T.
V-I-T. And yeah. I think it's just Evan's
there view, it is.
Whatever
there
it is. His, like,
I got it.
But yeah, I didn't think I needed it or wanted it or anything, but it just sort of took the pain out of like using like a command line JavaScript server that would do modules. I mean, I guess the browser is doing the modules, but it sort of does like the hot reloading and things like that. I didn't realize, and it's very fast, but it just took out like some of the pain that I had identified it as pain, but it was just like, oh, this is just like working and very low effort to get it working. It was pretty, I was impressed. That's all. I have very limited exposure, but I just was impressed based on, you know, whatever big Webpack configs or even setting up Parcel by yourself or, you know, it was a lot easier than I kind of maybe expected.
I'm really hoping that the longer we wait, the more cool it is that we didn't ever get around to shipping an NPM feature at CodePen yet, despite really trying to get that out the door, because eventually it will you'll just be able to hit some cool CDN directly and import the module directly, and it will just be fine.
That's the Deno dream for sure.
Yeah,
that's what Dano's doing. But then even browsers, I think I've heard conversations where they're kicking up the like, what if Node modules were in the browser sort of thing, and you know. And so I'm like, boy, if we're doing that again, like, let's see. But I'd be curious what happens there.
I would think the third age of JavaScript has some cloud stuff in it too, or has some like edge stuff in it. Like the idea that you can, that all these servers that are just, there's infrastructure all over the world of them can also run JavaScript, is going to start being taken advantage of more and more. Pretty bullish.
I would caution. I'm about to contradict you. caution people against getting too excited about edge servers, edge functions.
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever you call it, mainly because if you use them as real servers, then you really have pretty complicated distributed system problem. Whereas they're actually more designed for redirects and small rewrites, like based on your language or your location, will shift you to the right language version for you or whatever, or we inject some JavaScript at the edge, that kind of stuff. Much smaller than I think people are imagining things for, and you're still going to have to need to have some sort of air quotes origin to serve from your primary logic. It's exciting, but I think try not to do too much with it because it's not designed for that.
Yeah, it doesn't replace your origin. Okay. Okay, so let's do the DevX thing, because that's been like a part of your part of this world too, and we haven't even said it yet. So developer experience, shortened to DevX sometimes. Is it a job? Is it a thing? Is it a thing that companies think about? What the hell is it?
Yeah, it's basically customer experience when your customer is a developer, right? Like I think that's my sort of framing of these things and why it's more of a trending term. My last title at Netlify was developer experience engineer. Nobody knows what that means, but I think I was very inspired by your post on CSS Tricks. Marking out what do people think when they think about developer experience, and I think there are a lot of valid viewpoints there. And it's exactly as well defined as what customer experience is. Like it's everything, right? Like so, it's a very difficult and sort of vague job to pin down. But I think perhaps what you're going to talk about is is this becoming an industry? I think it is, basically because developer tooling companies and developer platforms are just growing and growing, and it shows that it's basically been shown that the best way to get developers is to sort of get their attention, write demos, make sure they're happy once they join and successful. So I definitely see this growing. I definitely see conferences and thought leaders and gatekeepers and stuff like that. And I think my most recent sort of obsession has been a lot of developer advocates. So there used to be an era of Google having developer evangelists kind of go out and yell at you from the rooftops. And then the vibe changed about 5 years ago to where it's more developer advocates, where it's kind of like a two-way street. And then developer experience engineering has been much more being more on the product team instead of a sort of shadow marketing team. And contributing towards the design of and shipping of actual products. All these sort of activities have been very much focused on the happy path. Look how easy it is to get started. Look at our great docs. Look at all these IDE integrations. These are all great things. But I think that we often leave developers alone with the unhappy path. So the way I phrase this is that there's a lot of with developer advocates, there's a lot of try, but maybe we should focus more on catch. And we should catch people where we have errors, where we have deprecations, where we're missing features, stuff like that. It's stuff that's not so nice to talk about, but people actually lose a lot of hair on when they encounter any developer tooling.
Is there a roller coaster of that? You wouldn't sit down to be to build a new company or a new product and think about the problems first, right? You have to build a thing, then people use the thing, then you can, start thinking about what it's like to fail at using it.
Yeah. You're a builder. You know how these things go. But I think a lot of people are not comfortable with sort of, at least a lot of people who work in DevRel don't really talk about that, right? Because I guess it's not polite conversation. But I think that developers are at a point where it's more authentic and people trust you more if you're also upfront with your flaws and where what you're missing on. And I'm hoping to move the industry, whatever minor cloud I have, I'm hoping to move the industry in that direction because I see a lot of people only doing happy stuff. And sometimes you gotta do real talk,
I wonder what you'll uncover there as your journey is going on. I like that you're already thinking about like politeness, you know, and that maybe if we're just avoiding it because of politeness, that's certainly like a fail, you know, like that's not a good reason to leave a developer, you know, screwed because, you know, your company's too afraid to talk about what it's like to fail using your product kind of thing. But it's tricky because it's tied into to marketing and stuff. I mean, if your product has a big, you know, public facing page about what it can't do, what does that do to the business of your company? You know, maybe there's some evidence that that's bad for business.
I think it means that it forces you to be secure about the value proposition that you do bring, and being confident enough that like, yeah, that's actually, we are the best in the world at this thing. And yes, we have a lot of other flaws, but when you come join us or when you use us, we are the best in the world at this one thing. And
that's great.
We're working on everything else and we know them, we publicly acknowledge them, hold us accountable. And I think that's much better than like, I don't know, like send in a support ticket and maybe someone will get back to you sometime, never. So, you know, obviously I feel strongly about this. I think the problem is not marketing. I think the problem is product, because it really, really, you know, I think this is, I kind of phrase this in my blog post as Conway's Law. So Conway's Law is where you kind of, the product that you ship is a reflection of your organizational structure. And the people that own the product, you know, and there's a title for these is product managers, product engineers. They have a strong say in this too. So who owns this, the experience of developers, and how do you interface with the roadmaps of different competing priorities, right? So I think that's where the real conflict lies, because there's no clear ownership. You know, what I got from recently, I think Andreessen Horowitz put out a podcast that talks about this. Amir Sherwood, I think he used to run developer relations at Twitch and then Microsoft and Google. He says that, you know, we basically have to organize weekly syncs between product and developer experience. And I think that's the right way to go, because... Yeah, developer experience. It's kind of, you're kind of like the representative voice of developers, but you also don't have the resources to do everything yourself, and you shouldn't.
No, that's a great way to put it. I recently, like in the last couple weeks or months or whatever, I've been evaluating a lot of like different GraphQL kind of whatever SaaS things. You know, just like I want a server, but I also want like a way to configure it or what, you know. Or I want the database, and then I want the GraphQL kind of endpoint. I didn't realize it till like I'd done like three or four, and I was like, oh, these kind of all solve different ends of the problem. Like one, I think, does like the just, it's almost like configuring a database, like, or it's like PHP admin, and then you like. It's kind of like, okay, we bring your own authentication. I don't know. We don't care. And then, you know, there's every sort of like tool does it sort of differently. I've like tried to evaluate all these things and then even I complained on Twitter, and one of their developer advocates like reached out to me, and they're like, what didn't you like about our thing? And I was told them like very straight, like, here's what I expected this and I got this. Or I expected like a GraphQL schema and it didn't have it. It was like, build your own, good luck. And they're like, oh yeah, we've heard that feedback before. And so, I mean, it was cool that they were like very honest that they had heard that feedback before, but it also didn't help me. So,
Okay. How would you improve that, John? Like, what would you do if you were in charge of that situation?
Look, like I don't want to, you know, make it about any particular company. So like Dave should not have had to tweet to find that out. You know, it should be documented clearly, and that like, you know, this is a common thing that people want, people need, and we don't provide. Here are the few different options. And just like provide a nice off ramp onto other services, for things that are very commonly held feedback. So like that developer advocate, I don't know who it was, but like when they hear that, yeah, we get that feedback a lot, and then they did nothing, because it was an uncomfortable conversation. I think, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of those, that's the kind of attitude that I'm hoping to change, that like, let's actually help people, even though it's not got, you know, even though it's sort of telling people like, here's a hole in our product and in our overall experience, like everyone using us runs into this, let's document it. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I recently had a win on this because I think I shipped it to the Amazon docs for the first time, a list of things we don't, a list of features we don't have, and the open GitHub issues where people are actively discussing all of these, and it's nice. Right there in the docs so that you don't have to dig around or like actually play with the tool before you run into these things, because it's expensive to evaluate tools. Like you have to go play with these things, run into the holes, then you go Google and dig up GitHub issues. What if they just all were on the docs because we're honest about what all the developers who actually use us face? And I think that's how you sort of treat your developers seriously like that.
Well, it sounds like you made like one doc for this, and I'm curious about that too. It could be a kind of cool phenomenon for companies to do. Like maybe every company should have a "what we don't do yet" page.
Yep.
That just is a big list or something of the things that you know is an admission that you don't do. The alternative being like sprinkling that information onto the docs pages that are relevant to that feature or whatever, which either way probably is better than nothing. But I kind of like the idea of a single page that has all these admissions on it.
Yeah, well, it depends on the size of your platform. The Amplify page would be very, very long. So I think sprinkling would make more sense. But yeah, you know, like you could also stick this in the UI. Like, you know, it's one of those, like, it's uncomfortable, but like it actually saves a lot of developer energy, and it also, I guess, it builds trust, because when people use you, they know exactly what you do and don't do, and they've picked you for that tool instead of assuming what you things that you have that you end up not having when people actually try you out. And so I think, you know, that's I almost put it as like a responsibility of the platform provider, because you know a lot more about this problem domain from having dealt with so many developers, that you should educate the people on these are the things that people need. Here are the mitigation factors, or here are just things that we plain don't have. And if we don't have this, please use other things. And I think that's something that open source libraries are also, pretty keen on as well. Like Redux has a thing on like why you should not use Redux. And I think that reflects a certain level of maturity. So I have another blog post on like documentation levels. Like your documentation should kind of match the level of maturity of your project. But certainly for any developer tooling platform that hopes to be used in production by other companies, you should be at a level of maturity that you can admit when you should not be used, and also document your holes.
Yeah, because if you let like your problems be self-discovered, you're delaying like
the inevitable. They're going to find out, and they're going to find out from like the worst representatives of like, people who are already disgruntled. I don't know. It's just like I don't like it when people kick me to like the community forum, and then I find out this super important thing that's hidden like five comments down. Just tell me, I'll deal with it.
Yeah,
I know nobody's perfect. Like I get it. It's fine. Just admit it.
I'd put stuff in the CodePen one that would say like, we support post CSS, but we don't support every single plugin in the entire world for post CSS. We support this limited subset of them, and this is how you use them, and this is how you request another one if you really need to use another one. And here's a weird hack that does allow you to use them. Little stuff like that, right? Which I don't think is in our documentation now. I think you'd have to kind of discover that on your own, just as an example.
I don't want to give the impression that documentation is like, where you dump everything. Certainly, the best documentation is the documentation that you don't have to read. And that, that involves, careful product design and either in the CLI or the UI, where you sort of pop up information or just, add in prompts and logs and warnings where appropriate. And I think that's better than like having one place that, you didn't read the docs? Too bad. I think that's also a pretty poor attitude to take to developers, because, there's too much docs to read. Nobody got time for that.
All right. I think we've kind of rounded out the hour here.
Yeah, we're borrowing money from Bezos here. So, Sean, thank you so much for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
You can find me on Swix.io. That's my site, which I will be shipping a new version of. And you can also find the book that I wrote at learninpublic.org. Yes.org. I hope to make that into a nonprofit soon. And I'm going to give a discount to listeners. I put a coupon, ShopTalk30. So I'll just paste that link in our Zoom chat.
Hey, there you go. Free money. So thank you very much. And thanks for all you do. You really contribute a lot to community and just developer experience as a whole. So thanks for sharing your thoughts. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star her favorite episode. That'll be a fine out of the show. Follow us on Twitter at ShopTalkShow for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to ShopTalkShow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.